You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honours. Good morning, Your Honours. May it please the Court, my name is Brian Davidoff. I'm a lawyer at Greenberg Lusker, which is counsel for the appellant in this matter, Musa Namvar. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please, Your Honours. Your Honours are aware that this is an appeal of two hearings. It's a consolidated appeal, and the importance of that fact is that in the underlying case, the appellee has really treated this as a single issue in the sense that the parole evidence rule really doesn't apply across the board. There were several pieces of evidence that were introduced into the bankruptcy court, which the bankruptcy court rejected for a variety of reasons. Some of the reasons were on the parole evidence rule. Some of the reasons were for other evidentiary reasons. Let me jump into the parole evidence rule. The central argument of the appellee is that, and the decision of the bankruptcy court was that the evidence that was submitted should not have been allowed in because either it was excluded out by the parole evidence rule or some of the other issues or some of the other evidentiary bases that the bankruptcy court excluded it. There are at least four reasons, Your Honours, that as to the parole evidence rule, that's wrong. The court's aware that in order to admit parole evidence, it's a two-step analysis. The first part of the analysis is whether or not the agreement is subject to differing interpretations. And that's a question of law. It's a de novo.
Could you identify for us what parole evidence you're speaking about specifically? Because it seems to me there's several different things here. And so I'm trying to figure out which of the evidence you're talking about.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, the pieces of evidence that we introduced were, number one, this letter agreement. Which is in the record at page 921, which was a letter agreement signed by both Mr. Esri Namvar in his individual capacity as well as in his capacity as the manager of Mission Real. That was item number one. I'm not going to go into the detail of that.
That's the 2008 letter.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's number one. Number two was the consideration. The court will recall that this property was purchased.
It's the evidence that money was placed in the accounts somewhere near the time that the property
Correct.
Was bought.
And the evidence is that my client, the appellant, paid just a little over 18%, $3,720,000, which represented his 18% of the cash.
Would have actually been 20%.
It was about 19%. The court's aware from Exhibit 6 to the trustee's report that there was a running balance between the parties, and there were debits and credits. And this money was shown in evidence introduced into the bankruptcy court, which was admitted as a deposit. It wasn't shown as a loan. It was shown as a deposit, and the payment actually precedes the purchase of the property.
Well, the reason I'm asking this question is I don't think that the court excluded the evidence of the deposit. It just didn't credit it as establishing an interest. They all have the last name, Mr. Musa's interest in the improvements. Isn't that fair?
That is a correct statement.
So it's not really a parole evidence issue as to that.
Your Honor asked what evidence did we...
No, I'm asking when you're talking about parole evidence, what evidence do you think was improper?
Well, at the end...
Parole evidence excludes evidence. So tell me what was excluded under the parole evidence.
What the court did in its conclusion, Your Honor, was to say... Let me back up. During the course of the hearing, the bankruptcy court excluded certain evidence on different evidentiary bases. At the end of the hearing, the court ultimately said, it's parole, everything's parole, I'm not allowing anything in. So there's somewhat of a conflict in the bankruptcy court's rulings. As to this piece of evidence, the consideration, Your Honor is correct, that the argument made by the appellee and what the court found that there wasn't a sufficiently close nexus.
It didn't prove to me that you had an interest.
Correct. And I want to address your Honor's question, and then I'd like to go back why I think the bankruptcy court was wrong in that regard. The court did exclude Esri's deposition, again, not at the end based upon parole, but really during the course of the hearing, the court excluded it on the basis of hearsay.
Well, because the trustee and the two bankruptcy estates were not part of that deposition and therefore had no ability to cross-examine.
Well, Your Honor, in fact, the counsel for the bankruptcy estate, not this counsel but another law firm, was present, And they did have the ability to cross-examine, and we point that out in the record, and that's not disputed. The other point, obviously, we make, Your Honor, is that the standard for the admission of a deposition transcript under Rule 32 is simply not applicable over here. Really, what is applicable is under Rule 56, which, and we've cited a legion of cases from the Ninth Circuit, where all that's required is to show that the deposition has the same probative validity as an affidavit.
And that if you use a deposition or an affidavit, the deposition or affidavit do not necessarily have to be admissible at trial, but the contents thereof has to be available for admissibility for trial use in some admissible form. So the question then is, even if you're right under Rule 56, would he have been available at the time of trial?
Your Honor, I don't, with respect, I'm not sure that that is the law, that he needs to be available.
Well, somebody to testify to the same facts that were in the declaration or deposition needs to be available.
The cases that we've cited from the Ninth Circuit indicate there were no cases that we could find out of the Ninth Circuit which indicate the requirement of availability of a witness at a hearing which is not trial.
I agree with that.
There was one case that we pointed out to the court, this Lederer decision, which was the Southern District of Ohio, where in that case, the court does specifically say that the availability of a witness is not required. And I would also point
out... let's assume we agree that you can introduce the deposition without regard to the availability of the deponent. But if, don't both the state's representatives have to be part of that deposition? In other words, can you introduce a deposition from another case?
Yes, Your Honor. And that, in fact, is what the Gulf Oil decision, a Ninth Circuit decision says. It's a different proceeding, and it's still admissible as long as it's on personal knowledge and made under oath. It's the same as an affidavit.
And that gets back to Judge Friedman's question. Even then, if the deponent is not subject to any cross-examination by the parties to this case, it's one thing if he's available, you could admit his deposition and also examine him. But you're saying you could admit a deposition from another case.
On summary judgment,
Gulf Oil decision. That is correct, Your Honor. But I want to get back to Judge Friedman's question. Regarding the availability or unavailability of the witness, aside from the Lederer decision, the Southern District of Ohio decision, one of the cases cited by the appellee is a case called Tormo, T-O-R-M-O-V, Yormark, Y-O-R-M-A-R-K. The appellee relies on that case for the propriety of the exclusion of the deposition. And when you read that decision, what it specifically says that it distinguishes out those hearings, what the court says, the requirement of availability of a witness does not apply to hearings in which evidence in the form of an affidavit is admissible. That's in that decision that's cited by the appellee.
I'm still confused here. Doesn't the rule require that the evidence be such as would be admissible at trial? For purposes of Rule 56.
In fact, Kerno specifically...
Well, I'm just talking, doesn't the rule say that? The rule says you must submit evidence that would be admissible at trial. It doesn't have to be in the form that would be admissible at trial. So you have a declaration or a deposition, that's fine.
So in other words, if I get a declaration from somebody and put it in, that's fine because we all assume that that person will be available to testify at trial. On the other hand, if I were to take a declaration that was written 2 years ago and we all know that that person is now dead, it's not just the form that's inappropriate. It's not just a form question, declaration versus later testimony. It's that I'm asking the judge to rely on something that I know I can't have available at the time of trial.
And the judge knew that here because he knew that
Your Honor,
didn't he know that Esri wasn't going to testify at trial?
Well, actually, there was initially the appellee took the position that our argument regarding the witness's unavailability was to be used against us, and now takes the argument that the witness's availability.
Well, without regard to their inconsistent positions, if you will, didn't everybody know that Esri was not available to testify at trial?
The only argument that was made was that he was incarcerated, and it was unknown at trial, frankly, whether he was going to be able to testify or not. Obviously, we hadn't gotten to trial at that point, Your Honor. This was a summary judgment hearing.
So, what you're saying is the judge should have said, I'm not going to treat that issue yet. Even though you're arguing his unavailability, I'll assume his availability, admit his declaration, and that created a fact question. Is that the way you...
That's argument one. Argument two, Your Honor, is that both the cases, both the Curnow decision as well as the Tormo decision don't require, particularly the Lederer decision, don't require the availability of the witness at trial. That's simply what the decisions say. So Your Honor asks about these various items of evidence. The Esri deposition, the next item is the September 15 email, which that was excluded out again on the basis that it was hearsay. Ultimately, the bankruptcy judge excluded it on the parole evidence basis. But the argument that we made to the bankruptcy court, and which we believe is correct, is that that September 15 email...
This is the 2003 email.
Correct, Your Honor, which postdated the closing of the transaction by approximately a month. That email was not offered for the truth of its assertion. It was not offered... That email was in the context where Mr. Esri Namvar sends an email to his brothers saying, let's make a donation to this charity based upon our ownership in Wilshire Bundy.
But why does Mr. Esri's state of mind make any difference in this case? If it's not asserted for the truth of the matter, why does his state of mind a relevant issue in this case?
Because it happens to corroborate all the other pieces of evidence which we sought to introduce, that is that there was an 18% interest that should have been allocated to Mr. Musa Namvar. That even 1 month after the closing of the transaction, that's what Esri thought. My brother's got 18%. And that had nothing to do with the transaction, with the argument that is being made now. It was an entirely independent transaction. So, Your Honors, there were five pieces of evidence that we sought to introduce. And the argument, the position of the bankruptcy court and the argument of the appellee is that it wasn't admissible, and the reason it should have been admissible under the parole evidence rule is because, again, if you look at the actual agreement which we're talking about, number one is that it permitted, Section 7.7 permitted that there could be an assignment to family.
Okay, but that was, thank you for pointing it out, because that was my question. What evidence is there that there was an assignment of interest from Esri to Musa?
The only evidence is, it's these pieces of evidence. It's the letter agreement, it's Esri's deposition, it's the fact that consideration was paid, it's the items of evidence which I've introduced to the bankruptcy court and to this court. That was the evidence that it should have gone to Mr. Musa. But the final point I want to make, Your Honor, is that all of these arguments regarding parole, and this is the critical issue, all of these arguments regarding parole cannot apply to the extent that this is simply an agreement between Esri and Musa. Remember, the letter agreement which we use as the basis of our foundation, that Musa was entitled to the 18%, that was signed by Esri in his individual capacity. If one is to, in addition to his representative capacity as a member of Mission Real, if one is to give any meaning to his individual signature, then the parole evidence rule cannot apply to him in his individual capacity.
So does that mean that the bankruptcy judge, assuming all your other arguments don't work, that the bankruptcy judge's ruling is okay as to the Mission bankruptcy, but not okay as to the...
Conceivably, yes.
And not okay as to the Nasri bankruptcy?
Correct, Your Honor, because... And when one looks at the letter agreement, that document itself is unclear where it's supposed to come from. Is the money supposed to come from Mission Real, or is the money supposed to come from him individually? Now, the appellee argues that, well, it really was only supposed to come from Mission Real, but that is, it's a real question of fact. That should not be decided at a summary judgment hearing. That fact alone, Your Honor, is not addressed by any of the parole evidence arguments. As to the admissibility of that letter agreement, we have asserted, as the Court's aware, that there was a verbal act. The fact that it was made, it was a contract. The only way you submit a contract is there was no challenge to anybody's signatures. No one challenged Esri's signature, no one challenged Musa's signature. The authenticity of that document was not challenged. What was challenged was what that document means.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Stephen Schwartz, Standing Gill, Diamond & Colitz. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellees, Mission Royale Associates, LLC, and Todd Nielsen. He's the Chapter 11 trustee of the Esri Nambar Estate. Now, Your Honor, what we have here is appellant jostling between two stories and conflicting arguments in order to manufacture disputed facts where none exist. In order to understand where we are, how we got here, you have to understand the initial arguments that they made as to his entitlement to this 18%. Now, appellant goes ahead and files a claim in the Mission bankruptcy case and says that everyone, notwithstanding what all the documents say, notwithstanding recorded title, notwithstanding the operating agreements, everybody always understood that I owned 18% of the proceeds. So we go ahead and we
Was that filed in both bankruptcies or just
No, it was filed in the Mission Royale.
Only in the Mission one.
Yeah, and even though appellant had never asserted an actual equity interest in Mission Royale, was not a creditor of Mission Royale, nevertheless, they go ahead and file a claim and says, well, the documents say what they say, but we always understood that I owned 18%. So we go ahead and we bring the lawsuit and we end up in summary judgment. And for the first time, after the interrogatories and the interrogatories, it's always the same story that everybody always understood that I owned 18%, notwithstanding what the documents say. So we get to the response to the motion for summary judgment, and for the first time, appellant takes a contrary position. Appellant says, no, actually, what really happened was that Esri assigned his interest in these proceeds to me. And our evidence of that is this 2008 letter agreement. Well, if you look at the 2008 letter agreements, the question that you have to ask is, what are they offering this for? Because really, you have two issues raised by this short letter agreement. One of which is, it says something along the lines of, if the documents, even though the documents don't say it, we've always treated this as my owning 18%. Okay, that's the hearsay, Your Honor. That's the hearsay, and it's there for to prove the truth of an out of court statement. Then you have the present agreement, which is for purposes of this particular transaction, right? You have this agreement is signed the same date as they go ahead and enter into an agreement to sell the property. And so for purposes of the transaction, because we understood before that you should have, that the documents are wrong and you should have owned this, that, you should, that we'll true it up out of Mission Royale and Civic Palms shares. Okay? That sale agreement never occurred, and that is not a legally operative document at that point.
Let me ask you the practical effect of this. I take it that from Esri doesn't want, you don't want the money to, he doesn't want the money to go into Esri's estate because there's other creditors for Esri's estate. Is that fair? So the way, if the 18% was his, Musa might be able to get it, but if it goes into Esri's estate, other people are combatants for it. Is that the way?
Right. Well, Esri Nambar, and the bankruptcy estate of Esri Nambar, owns 91.5% of the interest in Mission Royale Associates,
right,
LLC. So what happened was the
creditors of that estate don't want
the Nambar estate and Mr. Nielsen, who was at the time, by virtue of his trustee interest in Nambar, was the managing member and the largest interest holder of Mission Royale. They went ahead and they filed this voluntary petition for Mission Royale under Chapter 11 for the purpose of having the ability.
I was asking a very practical question. From the standpoint of the creditors to Mission, does it matter who has the 18% interest?
It's the creditors of Nambar that
matters. That's right. So that's really that's the connection.
Because it's going to it flows through. We have a confirmed plan in the Mission case, and all the other creditors are paid. And it's, what we're talking about here is the equity interest that's going to flow into the Nambar estate and benefit the creditors.
Right. And if Musa were entitled to that interest, it wouldn't flow into the Nambar estate.
Right. So Musa comes in and says, because even though the documents don't say what they say, everyone always understood that I own this 18%, so please give it to me and don't allow it to be distributed to the creditors of, you know, of the defrauded Esrine Ambar estate. So the real issue here is this idea of an assignment. Now, they call it a bunch of different things. At one point, they call it an assignment in the response to the motion for summary judgment. Then they come in and say, oh, we never said it was an assignment. It was actually an allocation. Well, clearly, if you look at the declaration of Musa Nambar that was filed in response to the motion for summary judgment, I mean, he says flat out, quote, Esri assigned to me the right to receive that portion of distributions otherwise due Esri from Mission Royale and or Civic Palm, which constituted payment of proceeds generated from the sale of the Wilshire Bundy improvements, so that I would receive 18% of the proceeds. And he says, I made my contributions on that basis. Well, Your Honor, they provided no evidence whatsoever that that was the case. You know, at best, what you can say is 5 years after the property was acquired, they realized that, well, I should have owned 18%, but we never did anything to actually fix the documents or to fix recorded title or to amend the operating agreements to reflect that 18%. So at the 11th hour, the property is going to be sold. He goes, Mr. Nambar, the two brothers get together, and Musa Nambar drafts this letter agreement saying, once this property is sold in this transaction, then, you know, don't worry, we'll true it up for you. Well, that sale never occurs, and there's no other evidence that there was ever a prior assignment. So that's why we come in and with the issue of parole evidence, because you have all of the documents say what they say, and the only evidence that we have here is you know, the word of Musa Nambar saying, I always understood that I owned 18%, and I believe that Esri Nambar did as well. And so to prove up Esri Nambar's portion, they go ahead and they lodge a deposition transcript of which my client was not a party. Neither of my clients were parties to. And they say, well,
respond to you. I want to hear your response to the argument that one of your clients was represented.
By somebody.
My clients clearly were not represented. My client's counsel happened to be counsel to somebody who, in that case.
Well, in other words, a particular lawyer representing a different client happened to be at that deposition.
Right. That deposition was
taken.
That deposition was taken in the Namco Capital Group case. Right. The lawyers for Namco Capital Group, there's a different trustee, right? It's not my client. It's Bradley Sharp is the trustee. The lawyers who represented Bradley Sharp in that proceeding happened to also represent Todd Nielsen in the Esri Nambar case. So what counsel is asking is for the court to take the leap that because counsel happened to that's some kind of a nexus between my client should have known what was going on in this hearing because his lawyers who represented somebody else in a separate proceeding were in that, you know, took that deposition. So, Your Honor,
now let me ask you. I want to go back to the 2008 letter. The sale referenced in that letter
did not take place. No, it did not take place.
So this letter on its face just says if a sale takes place, this is what will happen.
Yes.
Okay. So let's go back to the 2003 email. What does that represent in your view?
Well, the 2003 email, I mean, it's very interesting, Your Honor, that counsel should be coming in today and saying, well, that was not hearsay because it was there to evidence a state of mind. Okay. Well, if you look at the declaration that was filed by the appellant, Musa Nambar's declaration, he says the agreement that I would receive 18% of the sale proceeds is also confirmed by an email sent by Esri on September 15, 2003. So, Your Honors, clearly the purpose of them bringing this email into evidence is to, he actually says it, that it's confirmed, that the agreement that he was to receive 18% of the sale proceeds is confirmed by that email. Well, that's hearsay. This is not a verbal act. This is not a declaration of a state of mind. In fact, the panel was correct in stating that it really doesn't matter what Edwin Amber's state of mind is. What matters is, what do the documents say? What does the recorded title say? Who owns this property? And is there an agreement, is there any kind of agreement that can overcome parole evidence or that occurred after or anything that appellant can show that he actually owned this property other than the fact that he thought he owned this property?
Can you help me with the email? I'm just having some trouble figuring out who the one in the record. I'm looking at 236. The email says it's from Tony Namvar to various people. And then at the bottom, there's another original message from Sean Namvar to various people. And on the next page, there's one that just says sent and to. It looks like it's from Renee somebody. I'm trying to figure out who are these people?
They're all relatives. They're all the brothers. At the end of the day, there are a number of different limited liability companies.
Well my question is, if Namvar's state of mind is relevant, how do these messages from somebody else to Namvar, and I mean Ezra Namvar, demonstrate his state of mind?
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully submit that I did. This was not our evidence. This was the other side's evidence. But what I would say is, I don't believe that it reflects. I think that if I had to argue what they were, the purpose of putting this email, I think they're coming in and saying, of course he owned 18% because they went and the parties, as a celebration of purchasing this property, went and donated 18% of the amount of equaling 18% shares to a charity, something along those lines.
But my question is, I guess, not very precise. None of these emails are from either Mr. Ezra Namvar or Mr. Musa Namvar, are they? They're just two of them?
Not as far as I know, Your Honor.
And so those are two of the pieces of evidence. There's several others. Why would you address them?
Well, Your Honor, there was excluded evidence, right? There was the
is the deposition, the 2008
the deposition. We can talk about the deposition. Now, I think that the Court has already accurately addressed that.
What about the bank records, the financial records that show that a certain amount of money was put into the account?
Well, Your Honor, they submitted evidence which was not overruled on evidentiary grounds that at some point Musa Namvar put $3.7 million into the Namco bankruptcy estate. And what they're trying to establish is that, you see, I was always supposed to have 18% of the sale proceeds. What it doesn't establish is that there was an assignment or a transfer of any interest. And further, what it doesn't establish is that he's equitably or otherwise entitled to a share of these proceeds because, quite frankly, a lot of money changed hands between Musa Namvar and the Namco bankruptcy estate. The trial court correctly could not find any nexus between that money and the purchase of this property. And what's more is Namco Capital Group never received any interest, never claimed to have any interest in the property that was purchased. So
the contribution was to Namco Corporation and that didn't have an interest in the improvements.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the argument was that, well, Namco doled out cash to purchase different properties, but Namco never took an interest in this property to which he's asserting that he owns.
So was I correct when I asked your opponent this, that the judge admitted this evidence but didn't find it, that it demonstrated any that
That's correct.
That Musa, I hate these first names, had any interest.
What the trial court found was that they could not, that there was no evidence of any nexus between this money that was paid to Namco Capital and the purchase of the Wilshire Bundy improvements or his right to, or his ownership, his alleged ownership interest in the Wilshire Bundy improvements. Because at the end of the day, there's nothing other than this alleged oral understanding, which is in direct, which directly contradicts the fully integrated operating agreements and the recorded title to the property. And you have, and from an equitable standpoint, Your Honor, I understand that there's been, you know, they say, well, even if we can't prove that we owned it, we should be equitably shown to own it because we put in this money. Well, Your Honor, there are different bankruptcy estates here. There's a bankruptcy of state of Namco Capitals and a bankruptcy of state of Esri Nambar. They each have different creditors, and I would respectfully submit that it is not equitable for Musa Nambar, appellant, to receive based on a claim that Mr. Nambar has in the Namco Capital case for money that was paid to Namco Capital, that he should receive more than what the similarly situated creditors in the Namco Capital case will receive.
Wouldn't, and I know your time is up, so but please respond to this. Wouldn't any equitable claim be, in effect, knocked out by the trustee's strong-arm powers here?
Yes, Your Honor. The trustee under Section 544A3 as a bona fide purchaser would be able to avoid any equitable claim. And then, you know, the only issue that was raised in defense of that was that there was some kind of a constructive notice, but, Your Honor, I would submit that there's no chance that a trustee could have constructive notice of an oral agreement. Thank you.
I think we really are done now. But I'll give you a minute to rebut.
I'd just like to respond briefly to some of the points that were raised by counsel. First of all, with regard to the argument that there was a change of position, I do want to point out to the court that in our brief we pointed out that in the answers to interrogatories way early in the case, we did say, in fact, I've got it in front of me, it's on page 16 of our brief, in response to interrogatory number 2, we described that the distributions made by Esri and or Civic Palm would be allocated between Esri and defendant in a way to reconcile, quotes, the distribution shortfall. It is a position that we took earlier on in the case. It is not a change in position. The argument regarding the letter agreement, counsel makes the argument that because the underlying sale never happened, that it's no longer legally operative. But that really isn't the question. The question is the contract itself admissible? Is it a verbal act? And what the courts say in the cases that we've cited, the Pang decision, other decisions are, what is important, it lies in the question of whether or not it was an executed document. We can argue about what the interpretation of the document was, but that's an evidentiary issue. And, Your Honors, this is a grant of a summary judgment motion. This is not a trial. What I'm asking this court to do is to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which is what the court is supposed to do. It should not be weighing the bankruptcy court should have not weighed the evidence. Let me also address two other points, Your Honor.
Did they weigh the evidence, or did they decide that there just was no genuine issue of material fact?
Well, the court basically excluded everything that we wanted to introduce, so it never got to weighing the evidence. But the argument by the appellee over here, at least as to the letter agreement, is when you look at that contract, at that letter agreement, which really is a contract, it's a signed document, there's no question about the validity of the signatures, that document's no longer legally operative. That's their argument. They're making an argument regarding the interpretation of that agreement. The case law regarding a verbal act is that should have been admitted into evidence. And I remind the court that the agreement itself, you hear counsel saying time and time again, the document, the operating agreement, says what it says. It does. It says that there can be assignments to family members. It says even if there's an assignment which doesn't follow the operating agreement, you can still get an economic interest. That's what the document says. And finally, Your Honor, I just want to address your question about the September 15 email. It actually, the email was written from Esri Nambar. The final the top line of the email shows it comes from Esri to his brother saying, let's distribute the money this way. And the argument by appellee that It's been used to prove another issue, i.e. the ownership. That is not the question of hearsay. The question of hearsay is whether we were introducing that email to prove that the contributions were made. We're not. We're not. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. I thank you both for your arguments and your briefs, and now I think we truly are adjourned.
Thank you, Your Honor.